Millions march in Paris in support of those gunned down by extremists. We'll take your calls just ahead. Good Monday morning. Hope you had a nice weekend out there. And live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Keep on listening because in just a moment, we'll take your calls as we discuss the global conversation after the attacks in France and the worldwide response. Let us know your thoughts right now. Get on the line at 549-2937. Then later, don't miss our conversation with a national expert on end-of-life care and advanced care planning as he speaks here in Jacksonville this week at WJCT Studios. And sports with Cole Pepper, all of that ahead on the show. But first this morning, officials in France at this hour say they'll deploy 10,000 soldiers on home soil this week and post thousands more police officers to protect Jewish sites after the killing of 17 people by Islamist militants in Paris last week. The victims included journalists and police, and they died in 3 days of violence that began on Wednesday with a shooting attack on the political weekly Charlie Hebdo. It's known for its satirical attacks on Islam and other religions. Now, the horrific attacks sparked the biggest public demonstration over the weekend in French history, with a march through Paris that drew world leaders from around the globe. Many at the march carried signs and wore buttons that said, Je suis Charlie, or I am Charlie, in support of the fallen. The tragedy in France has once again brought to the forefront a worldwide discussion about the fight against radical extremism. This morning, we're continuing that conversation, and we're taking your calls. On the line with her thoughts, we're pleased to welcome renowned national security and foreign policy strategist Nancy Soderberg, a distinguished visiting scholar at UNF and a former high-ranking member with the National Security Council. Nancy, a pleasure to have you back on the program. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And joining us in studio, a First Coast writer and analyst who's covered the phenomenon of homegrown jihadists here on our shores, Folio Weekly columnist A.G. Gankarski with us in studio. Hi, A.G.
Hi, Melissa.
Great to have you both on the show. And here's our question to callers. Right now, we want to know your thoughts in the wake of the deadly Paris attacks. What are your thoughts and reactions? We'll take your calls in just a few minutes. Get on the line right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments on our Facebook page. Nancy, let's begin with you. It was extraordinary to see the solidarity in the streets of Paris Sunday. Everyone from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to German Chancellor Angela Merkel and many others linking arms and marching through Paris, more than a million people marching in France in the wake of these attacks. What were your initial thoughts as you witnessed that?
It reminded me of our 9/11. This was Paris's 9/11, where the world came together and said, we will not tolerate this type of action. We will not be cowed, and we're going to resist any kind of intimidation. I thought it was very moving that, you know, it was children, old people, they were all holding pens. Even at the Grand Awards last night in Hollywood, they were having pens as pins or holding pens. And I think the world is coming together and just shocked and horrified by this action and wants to come together. The risk is that there will be a backlash and make things worse, but last night and yesterday was a symbol of hope and unity.
When you say, though, a risk of a backlash, in what way do you think?
Well, the risk is that more people will come to the conclusion that all Muslims are a threat and trying to have believe that extremists is part of the Muslim faith. It is not. It's incumbent on the Muslim community to stand up strongly against this type. I thought the most poetic moment was perhaps the comments by the brother of the police officer who was gunned down by these terrorists and saying, my brother was a Muslim, but he was killed by terrorists, false Muslims. And that message needs to get out so that we don't have a stronger backlash. One of the blessings of America is that our Muslim community is very well integrated. You mentioned the second generation backlash. The homegrown terrorism is a bigger threat in Europe because there is more xenophobic. The Muslim community is not as well integrated. People come to the United States and the first generation may be somewhat isolated. By the second and third generation, they're fully Americans and fully integrated and less susceptible to this kind of brainwashing, frankly. And Europe has to grapple with that. And I'm afraid that the reaction is going to be the opposite.
We'll go to your calls on the attacks in France and the global response in just a moment at 549-2937. A.G. Gankarski, as Nancy mentioned, a Muslim police officer was gunned down in these attacks. A Muslim employee of a grocery store in Paris actually hid some Jewish bystanders from one shooting spree, and he's been hailed as a hero. At the same time, in Sunday's newspaper, local Fulbright scholar Parvez Ahmed, a member of the city's Human Rights Commission, wrote an op-ed talking about the rage sweeping through parts of the Muslim world and the pervasive feeling of helplessness and hopelessness, getting at the roots of this religious extremism, and also forcefully denouncing the violence and calling for Islamists to embrace nonviolence and distance themselves from all forms of militancy in the name of Islam. You've covered incidents of young American men being drawn to jihad. As Nancy mentioned, it's far less of a problem in America than it is in Europe, where extremism has become a matter of critical concern for European leaders. But still, what are your thoughts about the this phenomenon around the world that is drawing disaffected young men?
Well, a lot of it is also drawing disaffected young women using Twitter and other social media to draw them in, to recruit them to work for ISIS, especially in the last year we've seen it. You know, and it's really kind of interesting because you look at the development of jihadis, and there's a common profile. You have people who tend to be intelligent, who tend to be have their internal resources underused, and basically they're drawn in by the siren song of jihad, of, you know, fighting against the machine of, you know, the Anglo-American world order. And this is something that comes back to what George W. Bush said about a decade ago, talking about Islam being hijacked. And that's exactly what it is. I mean, what these jihadis represent is not Islam. It's terrorism. It's intended to destabilize, and has very little to do with the teachings of Muhammad.
Let us know your thoughts, callers, if you feel Islam is being hijacked in the name of religious extremism and terrorism. The number to join the show, 549-2937. Nancy Soderberg, here's a tweet from a listener. I'm disappointed that President Obama and Joe Biden did not attend the march. As you said, though, a moment ago, Nancy, this is a critical issue in Europe as leaders in Germany, France, other nations grapple with this issue of extremism. As a former high-ranking member of the National Security Council, how do you see the challenges before them?
Well, first of all, I would agree with the comment that we were underrepresented at this event. Our ambassador, who's a wonderful woman, Jane Harman, was there, but that really was, I thought, a big void. Everyone was asking where were the Americans. So at a minimum, Biden or John Kerry, who's popped up in Pakistan today, really should have been there. But that doesn't mean that we're not fully supportive. President Obama's already made it very clear we'll be sharing intelligence, we'll help them. There'll be a vast Monday morning quarterbacking. One of these individuals was in jail. The others were on our watch list. We knew that they were a problem. And the French officials say, well, we didn't have the resources to continue to track them. Well, that needs to be fixed. There'll be a lot more analysis of social media, all this, you know, sort of watching, you know, there'll be an anti-Snowden backlash after this in France where they'll say, yes, please follow our social media, because that, I'm sure, will have been clues to what was going on there. And we are not immune here in the United States. Our risk of the homegrown terrorists is less than in Europe, but it is very much here. We've had Americans join Al-Qaeda. We've had Americans join ISIS. We are very much that threat. Our 9/11 actions were committed by immigrants, not American citizens. But it doesn't mean that American citizens here will not be radicalized as well. So we need to be extremely vigilant. And I think the United States is very much focused on this. What will have to happen is looking very hard into how is the young woman who's the fourth accomplice able to transit Turkey. They know when she went into Turkey and now has disappeared into Syria, more closely monitoring the border, more closely monitoring the visas that Europeans can get to come to the United States for 90 days without having to apply for some visas. There'll be a tightening of all of that. And I think that we need to do that. This is a big threat, and it's a shock that it could happen in the streets of Paris, but it could happen in the streets of Jacksonville or anywhere.
Well, we want your calls right now as we discuss the worldwide outpouring of support and horror after the terrorist attacks in Paris. Let us know your thoughts. 549-2937. Let's go to Chuck in Jacksonville Beach this morning. Hi, Chuck. Thanks for holding. You're on the air.
Good morning. I don't see any solution to the issues between the different political parties involved in this, but I would like to bring the comment regarding the killings at the offices of the political magazine. That was a gun-free zone, basically. Had that happened in America, in New York City, in about 2 minutes, there would have been 50 police officers there with assault rifles. So obviously the gun-free zone in France, which has been done away with now. But my question is, in hindsight, I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that if your police officers aren't militarized, like we've been talking about, and they aren't carrying Glock 40s with 15 rounds, and they're not carrying rifles in their automobiles, etc., then instead of losing two or three, you're going to lose a dozen. So it's almost like Inspector Clouseau was running the show over there, but they figured it out now. And so I guess they will do away with the gun-free zones, and they'll be less likely to have less casualties. Thank you.
Yeah, Chuck, thanks for the call. That's Chuck at the beaches. We'll go back to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. AG Gankarski, France is deploying 10,000 soldiers on the ground this week and about 5,000 additional police officers around the country, in particular to protect Jewish sites. Now, the satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo, you, of course, write for an alternative weekly that has a satirical bent in this city, Folio Weekly. What are your thoughts about his comments?
Well, he made some good points. You know, one of the trade-offs that is made when you militarize the police and all of the security for liberty, I mean, yes, you have enhanced security, but you also have police on a war footing. And you look at what's happening in France, the protection of the Jewish sites, and this is all happening in the backdrop of a mass immigration of French Jews. So, you know, clearly this is not a new development in that Jews are feeling, by and large, insecure in France and, you know, throughout Europe more generally. You know, my question when you have, like, this extra deployment is how long is it sustainable? I mean, you can do it for a week, for 2 weeks, but you can't do it indefinitely without changing the nature of culture. And it also doesn't solve the real problem, which is, you know, the free recruitment of people from all across the world to perform jihadi acts. And in France, you have a lot of people from North Africa, a lot of people, you know, who are Islamicists and feel like second-class citizens. I mean, we heard a couple of years ago about riots in the suburbs of Paris. You know, and that's the energy that's being tapped into. So, you know, for France and for other cultures, including our own, that might face this threat, you know, it's not just a question of dealing with the immediate threat. It's a question of dealing with, you know, the persistent threat of people feeling motivated to do this.
Yeah, Nancy, we're witnessing this phenomenon of French Jews fleeing the country, immigrating to Israel, where they say they feel safer. At the same time, as AG said, young jihadists being drawn from around the world to places like Syria to join the Islamic State. And then at the same time, just the other day, separate from the Paris attacks, there was this extraordinary march in Germany of Germans marching against the influx of those of the Muslim faith coming into the country. How do you assess the way, how do you anticipate the way European nations will deal with these issues when it comes to multiculturalism, immigration, and dealing with this? What do you see happening?
Well, you've had a spike in xenophobism and anti-Semitism throughout the last decade in Europe. And it's very much correlated with a tanking of the economy there. You can do a regression analysis and correlation of hating anybody that's not like you when times are tough, and you always see the extremists rise in these types of things, and Europe is no exception. So this is part of a trend in the rising anti-Semitism that you've seen in a rising anti-immigrant culture throughout Europe, frankly. And what was really heartwarming yesterday was the signs were not just, I am Charlie, je suis Charlie. It was also, je suis juif, I'm Jewish, je suis la police, I'm a policeman. It was, I'm everything in this victim. You had Christians, Jews, Muslims, and police officers killed in this horrific attack. And what people are recognizing is that everyone is at risk. And what that means is, yes, you have to increase security. And I think that that will occur, and it is sustainable at a reasonable level, probably not at 10,000 all the time, but, you know, when you get the spike. But the real question here is prevention. Monitoring the conditions of the diaspora in Europe and here in the United States, more watching of the social media, and more looking at how can we prevent them. You can't arm every possible site because there's soft targets everywhere. So what you need to do is know what people are doing, watch them, and try and do more prevention. I think there will be a whole report that comes out of how did these people not end up in jail if they were on our watch list? Why did they get released? How could we not have followed this? Why are we not following their trek to Yemen and back? And a lot of you'll see an increase in surveillance and monitoring on social media, which I think is necessary in this dangerous age. You need to do it with the right civil liberties, of course, but I think that balance can be struck. And the bigger picture, of course, is what is feeding into the narrative of the extremists, falsely in my view, but it provides the narrative to get young kids delusioned with their own life is the crisis in Syria. We've been in Iraq for over a decade now. We pulled out and somehow missed the rise of ISIL, which is another Monday morning quarterback intelligence review. Well, how did we miss this? And we don't really have an effective policy, in my view, of addressing it. And we need to try and figure out how can we not have the Middle East spiral out of control, because it will become increasingly a hotbed for extremist warped views that youth falls into.
Lots of feedback, meanwhile, coming in online. Leonardo emails the show, it is a disgrace that President Obama was not present at the march. What does that say about the U.S.'s interest and devotion to liberal values, including freedom of speech and equality for all? I'm embarrassed. And an email from Marilyn down in Marineland, Florida. You must explore the cause, the root cause of Islamic extremism. Talk about the drones that are killing innocent people in the Muslim world. That wouldn't that cause resentment and a form of helplessness and wanting revenge? Lots of calls, meanwhile. We want your calls. 549-2937. Let's go now to Donnie in Ponte Vedra. Hi, Donnie. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just got a quick comment. The media, I feel, newspapers, magazines, everybody should show a little solidarity here with the issue of running one cartoon which outrages the extremist. Instead of everyone running and hiding and saying, oh my gosh, we can't run a cartoon that's offensive, every media outlet on the planet, magazines, newspapers, should perhaps run the same cartoon on the same day and say, guess what, folks? You can't shut us down. You can't scare us. And, you know, I know there's many, many other issues, but one gets a little weary of the media being so frightened of a few extremists. And I'll take comments off here. Thank you.
Donnie, thanks for that. That's Donnie in Ponte Vedra. A.G. Gankarski, the slain journalist at Charlie Hebdo, seen as heroes now, seen as exceptionally brave to fearlessly publish these satirical cartoons. They mocked everything. Let's begin with that. But they mocked in print, in images and text, the Prophet Muhammad. Now, the decision of media outlets around the world whether or not to show these images, some have, some haven't, out of concern for their employees' safety. What do you think about the controversy around that?
Well, it's a valid controversy. First of all, you have to look at what Charlie Hebdo was doing. It was very anti-clerical. It went after, the Muslims. It went after the Catholic Church. Those were primary targets. And, it was a very French-type sense of humor, more like somebody compared it to Rabelais. And, I'd hold to that. It's something that doesn't necessarily translate to the American mainstream press. I don't think that, say, the Florida Times Union could run those cartoons without not only leaving itself open for, some sort of backlash from, people offended by it, but also backlash from, readers and advertisers saying, "What are you doing running this stuff? It's beyond the pale." And, that's really what you run into is cultural sensitivities here and, specific French cultural sensibilities that, may not translate to other cultures like our own.
Nancy, what do you think?
I actually like the caller's suggestion to have the media outlets run a cartoon. I've looked at them online, and some of them are pretty clever. Some of them are probably over the top for some magazines, but I'm sure you could find one to do it. The freedom to make satire about leaders and public issues is a core of a democracy, and it must be supported. So I think that's a brilliant idea. There's been a lot of discussion, including on NPR, about why some have not done that because their editorial staff judged them to be over the top. But anyone can go on the internet and see them, and there are plenty of them that are very publishable, even for family audiences. So I think that would be a terrific day of solidarity to move forward. It's moving to see everyone holding a pen. The pen is my sword, is a French phrase from a couple hundred years ago. And I think that's very true. And that this will be, Charlie Hebdo's cartoons will be known worldwide because of this heinous act. And that in alone is a retaliation of this horrific act. But it is going to spark a major discussion throughout editorial boards of how far do we go and are we putting our journalists at risk? And I think the only answer to that is we can't succumb to that, but people will have to make some hard choices on that. I'm not I do a lot of writing, but I'm not an editorial newspaper, and I think they have a responsibility to weigh those images. But I think there's a balance where you can make it clear you can use editorial judgment, but you're not going to be cowed by lunatics and extremists threatening free speech.
It was striking to note, AG, that satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo is publishing this week on schedule.
Right, and they've gotten some outside funding to make sure that happens, including boosting the print run. And there is a lot of support for it. The one thing I would say regarding the global mass movement support of Charlie Hebdo is that, French politics is a more interesting and nuanced thing that we might see from this march this weekend. The real question is who's going to capitalize from this energy. There's a school of thought that says Marine Le Pen and the National Front may capitalize.
That's a right-wing politician in France.
Exactly.
And a lot of energy in France, isn't there, to limit immigration, to push back forcefully against extremists in France who have taken up residents from majority Muslim countries.
Right. And, there's a lot of, anti-immigrationist, language. And it's something that, how much power do you want to give those forces in French culture? It's going to be an open question who harnesses this energy and to what ends.
And let me just quote again.
Normally there's a spike in the wrong direction after events, and that's going to be the leadership challenge, to go after the extremists, but not the immigrants and Muslim and Jewish community.
And let me quote again from the op-ed, yesterday's paper by Jacksonville's own Parvez Ahmed. Just a little bit of it. "It is time for Muslim imams to lead their flocks in a rediscovery that shows free speech and free exercise of religion as an integral part of Islam. It is time for Western societies to stop asking Muslims what they feel every time radicals perpetrate yet another spectacular act of violence. Only then will Je suis Charlie find real meaning." 549-2937. Let's go to Lori on the West Side. Hi, Lori. Good morning.
Hi there. Excellent discussion. A lot of great points, ladies and gents.
Thanks.
And to add on, great segue into it. I really liked what the Pope had to say, because basically he said there is no reason to use religion as an excuse to kill people. It's really not there. And with that, I will say that I'm hoping that Louis Farrakhan will adjust some of his speech, because he basically says you're going to die anyway, so why don't you just die for something? And I think that's a little bit of a subliminal call. So I'm hoping that he will make a statement, too.
Okay.
So a lot of good points.
And
bye, guys.
Thank you, Lori. And Nancy, you mentioned this is a leadership challenge in France and in Europe. Do you feel that the leadership of those countries is up to that challenge to manage this in the right way?
Well, there's not been so far. And, you know, not to make it easy, but as the European economy tumbled down over the last decade, the nationalist politician, particularly in France, with Marie Le Pen coming up in the polls, the extremist, the anti-Muslim sentiment that is not tamped down enough by the leadership. I think that symbol of unity yesterday was really dramatic, where he had the chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, locked in arm with the French president, and you also had the Palestinian and Israeli leadership right there. And that's the symbol that they're going to need to bring home and push back against the extremists, which is very, very difficult after such a tragedy like this, whether they will do it or just turn around and try and attack anyone that doesn't look like them will remains to be seen. But yesterday was a very powerful step in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I do think, first of all, Parvez Ahmed is an extremely treasured individual in our community. He's a national leader, a voice of reason. And he's exactly right in that the Islamic leadership needs to stand up and echo Parvez's message of this is not Islamic, this is a hijacking of Islamist beliefs by extremists, and it has to be stood up for across the globe. There isn't a Muslim pope that one person can just say that, so it has to be community-based. And I think the message put out by Parvez is one that needs to be echoed around the world, and I wholeheartedly support his message. This is not Islam. This is a hijacking of a religion that is has no basis for these types of actions in it.
Yeah. And, you know, AG, an earlier caller mentioned the statements from the Pope. Is it a problem for the Muslim world that there is no one single unifying figure across the Muslim world who can speak for these millions of people of faith and denounce these acts? In this country, Muslims are constantly asked to denounce these acts of terrorism. When they do, as Dr. Ahmed did in the newspaper this weekend, many don't even hear about it because there isn't this one single prominent figure who has a worldwide platform to speak out.
It's not a problem in the sense of exercising faith for the Muslims. It is a problem we have, you know, these kind of crises, and you have people conflating, say, Parvez Ahmed and Louis Farrakhan, who come at it from two different points of view. I don't know if religions necessarily are intended to be monolithic. I mean, you look at something like the Catholic Church, and the Pope issues a statement, but even domestically, we have a lot of schisms in the Catholic Church, you know, not to mention globally. So, you know, it's a problem in the sense of having a rhetorical soundbite, but in terms of the larger dialogue and philosophical evolution, I don't know if it's a problem necessarily.
Cliff in Fleming Island. Cliff, thanks for calling. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. I was thinking of several cartoons that you could run in the local newspaper here, and you would have riots that would be a lot larger than the one in Paris. If you ran a photo or a cartoon of Jesus, for example, laying in bed with another man with the caption, first gay couple, or some of that order, you would have riots in Jacksonville that would be worse than Paris.
You think so?
So we're not any better. Well, when it comes to religious fanatics, we're not any better than Saudi Arabia or anyplace else. And, you know, you've got a couple of people on the city council that would lead the charge.
That's Cliff in Fleming Island. Nancy, do you agree?
No, I don't. I mean, I do think that we have certainly some individuals that would be outraged and protest, but to equate, you know, the reaction you'd have here in Jacksonville, you would not have lunatics gunning down the Florida Times Union editorial staff. I mean, that's the equivalent, which we're not that bad. There would certainly be huge outrage were we to run a cartoon like that, but we're a nation where we don't have that extremist living among us to the extent you have in Paris, thank God. But the caller's point is valid in that we do have extremists in our society. Parvez Ahmed was vilified for being a Muslim as he was put up for the Human Rights Council. And luckily, the citizens here rose up and denounced that behavior. And in fact, the Folio Weekly made him man of the year. The community came, rallied around and supported him and said, no, we will not tolerate that type of bigotry. So largely, the community stands up for the rights of our immigrant community or minority community. We're one of the most welcoming communities in the world. I teach at the University of North Florida, and it's a history of the world's wars that come here because our community welcomes the Iraqis, the Afghanis, the Yemenis, you name it, the Bosnians. They're all here and very well integrated, and they end up going to a great university, and that's the community that we're building. But the caller is right. We do still have bigots in our midst, but I think the majority reject resoundingly and loudly that point of view, and it is changing.
And that is a hopeful note as we continue to follow the discussion. We thank you both so much for being with us this morning. Thanks for appearing on the program.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
We were joined by foreign policy and national security strategist Nancy Soderberg of UNF and Folio's A.G. Gankarski this morning discussing the wake of the terrorist attacks in Paris. Later, don't miss all the week's sports news with our own Cole Pepper, but up next, why a new focus on advanced care planning is coming to Florida. That's right after this.
Spend some time in The Square, an online venue for local artists. WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville invite you to vote for your favorite submissions. Vote now through the end of the month. To learn more about The Square and to place your vote, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
The steamship Hannah M. Bell ran aground off the coast of Key Largo in 1911. Over the past century, the history of the shipwreck was forgotten. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Eric Denson from Diving with a Purpose, who helped discover the identity of the ship. We'll discuss early Florida tourism brochures and explore Audubon Society records at USF. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, he's one of the nation's foremost authorities on advanced care planning, and he'll be the keynote speaker at a special event tomorrow here at our WJCT studios. Dr. Bud Hammes will talk about the ideas behind Honoring Choices Florida, a first-of-its-kind program in the state. It's a long-term care initiative modeled after a similar groundbreaking effort in La Crosse, Wisconsin. And the purpose is to promote greater awareness and understanding of the importance of end-of-life care and advanced care planning, and we're pleased to welcome Dr. Bud Hammes to the program. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
So great to be with you. Now, recently, our own NPR's Planet Money program did a fascinating piece about what's going on in your neck of the woods, La Crosse, Wisconsin, where 96% of the people have their death planned out. They've done their advanced directives. They talk about it with their neighbors. They've taken care of that. How did that incredible circumstance come about in La Crosse?
Well, it started with, I think, the observation of some of us that all too often when we had to face these terrible decisions. Families were not prepared. They never had a conversation with the person who was sick and perhaps dying, and so they had to guess. That puts the patient or the person who's dying under a lot of extra treatment in many cases, but it also puts a great deal of emotional stress on families. Not just at the time the decision was made, but long afterwards, they often wonder, did I do the right thing? Should I have done something different? And it's a question which can never be fully or completely resolved because they don't know what the answer is. We in La Crosse decided that we could change that dynamic and at least offer every person and every family the opportunity to effectively think about these issues in advance so that when and if those circumstances arose, we would be clear about what the person who was sick would want us to do.
Now, you led the way in La Crosse through your capacity at Gunderson Health Systems. You were the go-to person when someone had a family member. How did you then formalize your ideas into an initiative that everyone in town could be part of?
Well, our first insight was the realization that the mere completion of a legal document wasn't going to be effective. It wasn't going to work, the mere completion of the paperwork. So the first thing we did was really focus on what kind of conversation do we need to have with patients and their families? How do we engage them in those conversations? And then we went about training people we call facilitators to actually facilitate these conversations because most of us, quite honestly and understandably, don't know what to talk about or how to talk about it. So we created guides, if you will, or facilitators to help people and their families have these conversations. And perhaps the second thing we did, I think that was important, it was we made it part of the routine of care. When you go in and you see your doctor, you may have your blood pressure checked or other kind of just kind of vital signs taken. As one of our doctors now says, that this has become like a vital sign. Hmm. Not that we ask a person every time we see them about advanced care planning, but at regular and planned encounters, we ask them, do you have an advanced directive? Can we help you have this conversation with your family?
The impact has been dramatic. Dartmouth Health Atlas reports that in La Crosse, Wisconsin, there is less money spent on healthcare for patients at the end of life than any other city in the country. That's extraordinary.
Yeah, and what this, I think, really shows is not that we're denying people care or rationing care. What I think this really shows is that when you allow and help patients and their families think about these issues, they make different decisions. Quite honestly, if you want to put it simply, no one wants to suffer needlessly at the end of their life. I think we're all self-interested enough to say, gee, if I get to that point, I don't want to go through more stuff just to die in a more miserable way. And when we can clarify that, families can understand it, and we document it well, we act differently, and I think in a sense, and quite honestly, more compassionately.
And certainly compassion is at the heart of this. But as you touched on, there has been fear and backlash to this change in mindset. The notorious phrase, death panels, comes to mind.
Right.
During the fight over the Affordable Care Act, this fear that loved ones' care at the end of their life would be rationed. What do you say to those who have those concerns and see this through that lens?
Right. I think in the debate over the Affordable Care Act, the issue was focused on the government making the decision for us. This program, quite honestly, is focused on each individual making the decision for themselves. And I think that's why this is not scary to people in our community and to other communities where we've taken this. The focus has always been on the individual and their family making their own decisions for themselves so that when they get into the healthcare system, the doctors and nurses and other health professionals can understand who this person is, what their values and goals are, and how to take them care of them in accordance to that and in that sense more respectfully. There are patients in our system who want more care than other people. We're able to distinguish those people who want more and those people who say, this is where I want to stop, and we care for each person according to those values and goals. I think this is just a more respectful way for us to deliver care, and it actually keeps the government out of it.
interesting in. Let's discuss then the local connection. A community hospice of Northeast Florida is facilitating a long-term initiative here on the First Coast modeled after the program you have so successfully established in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Can you tell us a little bit about Honoring Choices Florida?
Well, Honoring Choices Florida is really a collaborative effort led by the Hospice of Northeast Florida and most of the other health systems to make this part of the routine of care. By that, I mean that there are planned ways to engage patients and their families. There are facilitators trained. There are standardized materials. And when this is done as a community effort, it's easier to get the message out and to effectively help people plan. So in the next round here, as they move more out into the community and make this more part of the community culture, it doesn't matter where in Jacksonville you receive your care, the way you should do advanced care planning will be the same. So whether you're a patient at Baptist or Mayo Clinic won't make a difference. Mm-hmm. The planning and the approach to planning will be the same. And so now you have the ability, so to speak, the platform from which to engage the community in an effective fashion.
Well, as we continue to follow this, as we mentioned, this is a first of its kind for Florida. So it's exciting for WJCT to host you here this week. You'll be speaking about this at an all-day event here in our studios tomorrow.
Right. I'm really excited about that and to hear the progress that has been made in the last 6 to 9 months.
Well, Dr. Hammes, it's a pleasure. Hope it's a little warmer here for you than in La Crosse right now this time of year. So enjoy your stay, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Bud Hammes joining us, and we're back in a moment with sports.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, following the deadly attack at a French satirical magazine, the latest on the investigation and debate over cultural sensitivities and self-censorship in an era of global terrorism. Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
All your favorite oldies tonight at 10 on Route 66, only on 89.9 FM.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet...
And who doesn't?
We're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
WJCT and the Florida Theater present Wildcrats live on stage at the Florida Theater, February 16th at 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. Watch the Krat Brothers bring their creature adventure fun from the popular PBS Kids series to life on stage. Tickets available at floridatheater.com.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, college football's national title will be decided tonight.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Cole Pepper has an advanced look right now in sports. And Cole, I have to tell you right off the bat, I am from Dayton, Ohio.
Yes.
My parents go to every home game in Columbus.
Yes.
Just letting you know that.
And I know you have other Big Ten ties, obviously.
I do.
Right? Northwestern.
Yes. Obviously, they're not in the hunt.
No.
But anyway, it's Oregon facing off against Ohio State.
Yeah, it's the first year the college football's had a playoff at the highest level. Interestingly enough, Oregon and Ohio State faced off one other time in the very first ever championship after a playoff for college basketball.
Oh, really?
Back in 1939.
Get out.
Yeah, so ironic that it comes around here. Ohio State has used three different quarterbacks this year, and Urban Meyer, the former Florida coach, is trying to win his third national championship. It would be his first at Ohio State. First two came in Gainesville. On the other hand, Oregon has the Heisman Trophy winner, quarterback Marcus Mariota. After what they did to Florida State,
yeah.
Sorry to
disappoint them.
I'm picking Oregon big in this one.
All right.
I think the injuries at quarterback for Ohio State are going to catch up with them, and I think Oregon's got too much speed for a Big Ten team again this year.
Yeah, Oregon's really had quite a year.
Yep,
yeah.
They've been terrific.
We're in the offseason, but the Jaguars' search for an offensive coordinator continues.
Yeah, one of their candidates, Greg Roman from the 49ers, is reported to be close to becoming the Bills' offensive coordinator after the Bills hired Rex Ryan as their head coach. There is another candidate for the position, recently fired Bears head coach Mark Trestman, who has quite a track record with quarterbacks in particular. It is so important for the Jaguars to find an offensive coordinator who can, along with Frank Selfo, the quarterback's coach, help develop Blake Bortles. Because if Bortles doesn't develop, things are going to get blown up again. And it's just they're not going in that direction. Speaking of Selfo, he'll serve as the offensive coordinator for the Jaguars staff when they coach the college prospects at the Senior Bowl, second time in as many years that the Jaguars staff has been selected to work with the college seniors at the Senior Bowl. Now, obviously, they need to improve on the three-win season. There's no doubt about that.
Lackluster at best.
Lackluster, they would take, because that the three is not lackluster. Three is not good at all.
Yeah.
And as you might expect, fan interest reflected that. A recent report by Scarborough, the research company, says that the Jaguars' popularity dropped from 65% last year to 54% this past year.
Oh.
And here's how they determine it. They basically take the percentage of people in a city who watch, listen to, or attend a Jaguars game. And places like Green Bay are very high on the list, as you
might
imagine.
Right, of course.
And really, the core, the cities that do very well are the smaller markets that win, have very high percentages here. Because a place like New York, there's a lot of different things to do and different teams and so forth. The Jaguars are 21st in the league in that category. And I'll state here that the best way for the Jaguars to improve in this survey, pretty simple. Win more
exactly.
games.
Exactly. Yeah, it's
more
not
relevant.
It's not complicated.
No, it's a simple thing. It's one of those, you know, do as I say, not as I do kind of things sometimes.
Well, if we're 21st, who's at the very bottom?
I'd have to go back and look at the full rundown. But mostly, you know, the New York teams don't score particularly well because you've got two teams in the same city. So it splits, you know, you're not going to go to both games so much. And so the larger markets and the ones that aren't winning. So, you know, the Jets didn't help this year.
Yeah.
The Giants struggled a bit this year as well.
Speaking of the NFL, we're down to the conference championship games. Gosh, it's that time already.
Yep, we're down to the last four. And after this past weekend's games, we'll have the Patriots hosting the Colts in the AFC and the Packers travel to the Seahawks in the NFC. So here are the storylines for these two games. You have the old gun versus the young gun in the AFC with Tom Brady facing Andrew Luck. In the NFC, it's the defending champion Seahawks against the probable league MVP, Green Bay quarterback Aaron Rodgers. So here's my prediction for the Super Bowl matchup.
Yeah.
I think we're going to see the Patriots and the Seahawks play for the Lombardi Trophy. Check my work next week. We'll see if I get this right.
So it's going to be either Boston's eating crab or Seattle's eating, what are they going to make, baked beans? I'm trying to think.
The mayors always make
those. Yeah, they always do that.
So it could be Boston baked beans or New England clam chowder, maybe, something like that. And then you'd have either, Northwest salmon or maybe just a lot of coffee.
There you
coming from Seattle.
Yeah, there you go.
We'll have two notable soccer events this week, by the way, in Jacksonville. Wednesday, the Jacksonville Armada will announce at least three local players who have been signed to the roster.
Oh, wow, that's great.
People have local ties here. We're just 3 weeks away from the inaugural game for the Armada, February 7th, against Philadelphia Union of the MLS. And Saturday, two German teams face off against two Brazilian sides at Everbank Field as part of the Florida Cup. Should be a fun day. Included in that is Bayer Leverkusen, who is a Champions League team, which just means they're one of the best teams in Europe. And both of the Brazilian sides have great tradition as well. So should be a big opportunity for, again, Jacksonville to get some international attention. Those matches will be broadcast to 250 million households around the world.
That's terrific. Yeah, the Jacksonville Sports Council and City Hall, they've really been trying to attract these big-name international sports events to town.
Yeah, part of it is about putting, you know, and sometimes it's a big spectacle, and sometimes it's a smaller thing. You remember the powerboat races, mm-hmm. but it puts Jacksonville on the map internationally. You start to connect that. And it's interesting, this has been growing and growing and growing, and how, you know, we'll see March Madness back in Jacksonville. That's a big part of things as well. Florida Georgia, of course, Players Championship, Jaguars games. Mm-hmm. All these things continue to get more attention for Jacksonville. The big key off of that is, can you capitalize on that attention from a state and local business standpoint?
Absolutely. Let's hope so. Speaking of attention, all eyes will be on Culpepper, as you will be on the TV calling the Armada games. Can you tell everybody where we can watch you?
Yeah, that'll be on CW17 and also online. All the matches will be streamed through the NASL website, NASL.com, North American Soccer League. And so starting with that preseason opener, the inaugural match, February 7th, we'll have the broadcast. And I actually have a collection of analysts who will be joining me throughout the year, including Andy Kidd, who is the athletic director at Episcopal High School, who played college soccer with Clint Dempsey, who's on the U.S. men's national team.
Very nice.
Mauricio Ruiz, the head coach at JU, Brazilian-born and a great soccer guy. David Hayes, who lives here in Jacksonville, who was a former professional in the MLS and a captain of the Portland Timbers once upon a time. And then Bob Veal, who was a former English semi-pro player who's coached soccer for over 20 years. And so we've got a lot of soccer knowledge to join me in the broadcast booth.
It's all-stars. And Cole, one of our all-stars, follow him on Twitter, at @ColePepper. Always great to see you. Have a great week.
Thanks, Melissa.
That's our program. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Shevchuk. Next on Diane Rehm, the global reaction to the deadly terror attacks in Paris. Keep listening for that. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.